Blog Talk Radio.
I grew up on this mountain, came back here to dwell. Maybe have a family, plant some corn and dig a well. I was all done with the army, back from Vietnam, where I learned how to shoot a rifle and how to set a bomb. I grew up on this mountain, it's in my very soul. So when the company moved next door, started digging for the coal, tearing up the mountain with drillers and drag lines, I knew then what needed to happen to those mines. 10, 9, 8, sometimes that's just how it goes. 3, 2, 1, get out before it blows.
All right, welcome to Bottom Up Radio Network. Hey. Broadcasting live from the Muddy Waters Collective in an undisclosed location on Belma 20 something. Sounds good. This is your host, Rob Rouser.
This is G20 Side of Dice.
Tonight on the show, we're going to have an esteemed colleague of ours, one Mr. John Zerzan, is going to be joining us in a bit. But first, we've got Seth Martin of the Menders going to play us in. Seth, give us a song, bud.
Feel free to stomp along, folks.
Been feeling so cold. Oh, been feeling so cold. Oh, I still own all of my soul, but everything else of mine's been sold. Been feeling so cold. Here we go. Oh, been feeling so cold. And ooh, I tell you no lies. Oh, I tell you no lies. We told ourselves when those kids were dying, no other choice, evil they was hiding. Ooh, I tell you no lies. Oh, I tell you no lies with me. Keep it up. Ooh, now my finger's so thin. Oh, now my finger's so thin. And I had so many fine friends back then, when the world had me killing evil women and men. But ooh, now my finger's so thin. Oh, now my finger's so thin. Here we go. Screaming, what for? Shot that old woman and she fell to the floor. Ooh, I fought in that war. Oh, I fought in that war. But ooh, I won lots of medals. Oh, I won lots of medals. Yeah, I ground up the children, yeah, I'd into the gravel, and I watched those big old cities being leveled. And ooh, I won lots of medals. Oh, oh, I would like to know. Well, when I came home, oh, when I came home, Came home, called the Savior, but left all alone. Waking up every night, hearing their moans and ooh. Oh, when I came home. Oh, oh, when I came home. Here we go. And we never let poor kids get in our way. No, ooh, it's the truth they will see. Oh, it's the truth they will say. Last verse, but ooh, I've been asking the old. Oh, I've been asking the old. Many poor fighting down these rich folks poor, but never heard of no poor getting rich folks cold. Ooh, I've been asking the old. Oh,
all right, that was Seth Martin. Seth, what's the name of that tune and what album is it on?
Called Feeling So Cold or Ballad of a Winter Soldier, and it's not on an album yet. So
it's next album maybe?
Be on one probably in January.
And the origins of that song is based in a bit of nonfiction, correct?
That's right, yeah. It's I was doing some research. I was reading the old oral history, Studs Terkel's The Good War, when I was in Korea, and came back after writing a ballad based on those oral histories of everyone coming back to the supposedly good life. And how disillusioning it was for our soldiers to come back realizing that they were part of the machine too, and that the country that they supposedly were fighting for was a sham. And when I got home, I found out that it was also the same story for one of my friends who was in Korea and then Iraq and came back with PTSD and hung himself. So.
All right. Well, that's fucked up. Thank you. Thanks for sharing. Seth's going to be joining us throughout the night, everybody, playing some tunes. Seth actually was one of the bridges of the relationship between Zerzan and this show. And so it's nice to see communities be able to come together in many different aspects. And but we're going to have some fun tonight, right?
Post-traumatic stress syndrome. That is the most candy-ass way to describe people getting fucked up from a war. That sounds like something like I had a bad day at work. You know what I mean? And I had this dick who wanted a really complicated sandwich. And Jesus Christ, it was hard to make. I'm so stressed. It's called shell shock. When you fucking watch people explode in a rain of guts, that's not stressful. A day at the mall is stressful. Okay?
Back in traffic.
Yeah. The DMV, standing in line at the post office, that's fucking stressful. Jesus. But last time I checked, it was shell shocking. Indeed.
That's right, yeah. I don't know if you were hearing what Seth was saying, but yeah, it's just all degrees, varying degrees of a battle against ourselves, I think, that we're dealing with. And maybe nothing other than war really pulls it to the core of the destructive nature of civilization. Now, I didn't say the destructive nature of man or of humanity, but of an institution which exists upon consumption and destruction. Who knows? On a lighter note, how the fuck is everybody in here tonight? All three of them. Oh, great. We got some headlines this week. Some of these are coming thanks to the comrades at infoshop.org for all of your Anarcho news needs. Infoshop.org.
Wikipedia.
Wikipedia. The U.S. is gearing up to sell off a lot of indigenous land, and they're using the IRS as reasoning for that. It's land that is under the care of the Crow Creek Sioux tribe.
Who are they? I don't know either.
Exactly. Apparently what's happened here is the sense of humor of this room has been left at home, apparently. That's happened.
But don't worry, we brought...
If genocide isn't funny, what the fuck is, people? Come on now. Let's laugh a little bit, okay?
Find the funny.
You're all white. You're all white. It's okay.
Yeah, you're all safe here.
No, that's a joke, too, because I know
joke,
that you're not...
That was not literal.
Wow. At any rate, apparently what happened with this is there was some buying and selling of land, which was reservation land, and it was bought and sold, even though the people of the Crow Creek Sioux tribe don't believe that you can buy or sell land. It was bought and sold, thereby putting it under the realm of the IRS, and they're getting ready to take it back, or charge the Crow Creek, which is one of the most impoverished tribes in the world, not just in our country, but in the world. $1.8 million in back taxes. So not only do we come, rape, and take your land, but we...
send you a bill.
Yeah, exactly. It's great. It's pretty interesting, though, when you look back through the history of these tribes and the resistance in which they are still fighting and have been fighting since day one. It's interesting when you think about what our threshold is for why... people want to say, are you going to start a revolution? Is that what you're trying to do? No, I'm just joining a resistance that's been in play for thousands of years, really. Not just the last 400 of American culture, but thousands of years. Jesus Christ, people. This is fucking crickets in here.
Yeah, I know. You're killing
come on,
it.
Get up. Get some, give you're me some noise. It. Jesus. You're all fucking...
I want to save the earth because I'm so happy to be alive. There's so much joy. Why don't people join us? We're fun.
So yesterday I was thinking about stuff, and I realized that I have graduated from anti-civilization to anti-cosmos. Fuck space! Fuck the fucking Mars, fuck Venus, fucking Saturn and its stupid rings, fuck the sun, fuck the moon, fuck Pluto, because Pluto is A, not even a planet, B, is frozen, C, is not a Disney character, it is a cold ball of lies. Burn it. Burn space. You know, and stars aren't even fucking stars, they are lies of light from shit that used to be alive. Fuck space. Space has sent us asteroids, which destroyed the I, for one, would like to see dinosaurs. Can I? No, because fucking space destroyed it. Fucking space.
You've got a microphone. Fucking you don't have space. To yell.
Destroyed.
My co-host, Alex Jones, over here.
This is the biggest announcement on burn.
This is breaking news here. This is the most important thing you're going to hear today. The New World Order is taking over those sons of bitches
by gold.
Double cheeseburger! You understand what that means, New World Order bastard.
I want you to buy this DVD and this DVD.
Let's get it out of the way.
Alex Jones is a CIA agent.
He's a CIA agent, he's a cop, and I hereby challenge Alex Jones to a shirtless fight in the street anytime, any place. Every week on Burn, we challenge him, and every week he ignores us because he's a fucking coward. Alex Jones, shirtless, street. Bring the bullhorn. I don't care. Anytime, any place. Next. Wikipedia that shit, Carl with a K. Everybody give it up for Carl with a K over here. He's running our tech support. He's going to make us sound smart. Whenever anybody asks us a question, he can Google it. Wikipedia. We can sound like fucking genius. Yeah, you're a fucking cop.
Snap.
I do it.
Snap.
That's all right. The poor kid still believes in eco-communism. Can't help it.
So there's a mining company that got charged $1.79 billion by the United States government to settle a series of claims for the cleaning of one of over 80 sites. And I thought this was really interesting when I was reading this, because this is one of the many things that I spent a lot of time looking at is what are the ways in which those in the sort of political class will do things that gets the public jazzed. And they'll say, oh, see, check them out, man. It says, we're going after this evil business. We charged them all this money to clean up all their spills. And all you got to do is just look at the amount of money, $1.79. That means some motherfuckers getting rich and nothing's going to get cleaned up. This is like the grand illusion of the system. It's like I said last week, it's like a Stockholm syndrome where whenever you read stories like this, it doesn't mean a fucking thing, guys. It doesn't mean anything. And any friends of yours that want to tell you that it does, it's wrong. This is just a huge transfer of wealth from one organization to another, a little bit of circus type of action to make us believe that those in power are working for us instead of against us. And speaking of circus, this plays into the whole Willamette River.
Yeah. This is great. On my bus ride down here today, I stopped and grabbed the Portland Tribune. Now, this is quality journalism here, the Portland Tribune. However, I didn't have to look any further than the first page to read so many demoralizing articles right on the cover of the Portland Tribune. The one that's going to tie into this, there's actually two of them. There's a ban on drilling that's about to expire. So it's January 22nd. There's a moratorium that expires, enabling oil companies to propose exploratory wells in the state's coastal waters. Exploratory. Now,
that's nice.
It sounds good.
Exploring.
I mean, are you against exploring? What are you? You don't like the Jews all of a sudden?
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Leave the Jews alone
racist?
For once.
That's getting ready to come up January 2nd, everybody. Grab your black rags and let's go have a party. Controversy swamps river plan. This was one that was really fucking interesting to me. Apparently, the good people of the Portland city government have taken it upon themselves out of their good nature and green economy to fix the Willamette River. And what I mean when I say fix is they're going to plant 15% of the land with new vegetation.
Flowers.
And they're going to force companies to do this. And that's going to fix it. That's going to rehabilitate the land. But companies don't like that. They're really upset about it. And there's now the Working Waterfront Coalition. They have a clashing of labor, division of labor, and environmental policy coming to fight one another. They're arguing that to rehabilitate the Willamette River in a way that is somewhat ecologically peaceful. Of course, when you're hearing from the state or from businesses about what is ecologically sound, that just means that they're going to kiss you after they fuck you. They're in no way going to return this once pristine river to its glorious mass that it once was. However, they're not going to do it at all. There's delays and delays and delays. And these companies, there are a few companies listed in here, and I'd like to read the names of these companies because as our dear friend Utah Phillips once said, this world is not dying, she's being killed, and those who are killing her have names and addresses. So let's just give some of this here. Oh, and the Audubon Society is involved too, so rest assured, things are going to change. They're going to draw pictures of the river and publish them.
And then ask you to subscribe to one of their newsletters.
Right, but they're going to give 10% of the income to somebody. We got Vigor Industrial is one of them. It says T. Allen Sprott, who's the vice president. Remember that name, T. Allen Sprott, vice president of Vigor Industrial, welcomes this delay. So go home, write it down, Vigor Industrial and T. Allen Sprott. Give him a call. Let him know what you really think. A few of the other companies are Shaver Transportation, Tugboat Company, Gunderson Incorporated, Schnitzer Steel Industries. Oh, but they give us places to hold plays. The Schnitzer. Oh, God, I didn't want them to be bad guys. Shaver Transportation, Schnitzer Steel, Gunderson Incorporated, and Port of Portland are the Working Waterfront Coalition. I'm going to say those names one more time if you want to write them down, if you want to look them up for our listeners at home. Schnitzer Steel Industries, Shaver Transportation, and Gunderson Incorporated Barge Building Company, and the Port of Portland. These are all people who are standing in the way of a menial amount of reform that has been fought for in boardrooms all over the city. They're on the front lines of the boardrooms, people. They're really fighting hard for our ecology. So let's help these paper pushers and give these people a strongly worded letter. And I'm sure they'll change their minds after receiving the strongly worded letter.
When I was 14, I saw John Tesh live at the Schnitzer with my mom.
The guy that did the sax on the beach and sax by the fire?
Who came up with the NBA. Same John Tesh.
Wow.
Same one. Yeah, I like his old shit way better than his new shit.
And it's starting to become painfully clear why you play fantasy games.
Yeah. You know, there's a conspiracy theory that says he's an alien, too. I don't know, you guys. A lot of information comes out of our
show.
Is that
David Icke thing? Does David Icke have it up for Jim Trash?
Who's David Icke?
Oh, who's David Icke?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, man. Prepare to enter a whole new world once you enter the world of David Icke, former footballing star who claimed he was Jesus. Now he claims that the Jews come from reptilian bloodlines.
Yes!
And his proof is a Swahili medicine man who's 92 years old that told him this in a dream.
No way!
That'd be real.
Awesome. I love fucking reptoids. I'm a huge fan of the Hollow Earth theory. Do we know the Hollow Earth theory? Hollow Earth theory says that the core is a sun inside of the planet, and right beneath the surface are fucking unicorns and leprechauns and elves and fucking wizards and shit, and there's like a whole world, and there was this dude that like got some money, got like a grant to go. No, this is a real guy. They got a grant like to go explore the mountains. These little fucking like holes that you can look at from space that have like mist coming out of them. They're like, whoa, that's one of the entrances to Hollow Earth. This guy got money, and I would go to the Hollow Earth. I fucking would. I would go even if I knew for a fact it didn't exist. I think I would probably go anyway.
You can Google Hollow Earth Theory, or you can do a Yahoo search for it, but rest assured that any Yahoo search you do will now be sold to the government. Some hackers recently, I got this article off of InfoJob. Yahoo issues takedown notice for spy. Apparently Yahoo, Verizon, and a few other web managing companies have had this ongoing price list for spying services to sell all of your information to federal authorities. Now, not just any of us can buy this stuff. You have to be, you know, a federal authority. Yeah, like right back there, our barista. Federal authorities. She's buying it. Apparently, it's pretty cheap, too. It's pretty cheap to buy all of the information. It's $30 to $40 to buy your email list from Yahoo email,
yeah.
Or $40 to $80 to get your whole Yahoo groups. But Yahoo has asked them kindly in a strongly worded letter backed with lawyers to remove this from their website, and these wonderful hackers at this website, Cryptome, that's the whistleblower site apparently, refused to remove this information with this list. So it's not just for people who wear tinfoil hats anymore. They really are watching and listening to everything that we do.
$20, man. I would like to think that my email is worth more than just $20.
Dude, I've read your emails.
Yeah.
Not worth $20, bro.
True. Why is my gaming subscription canceled? That's my email.
Looked like we had a caller on the line for a moment, but the caller hung up. Oh, call back, caller. If you want to talk on the air, call back. So what else you got going on in the headlines?
Okay, so I read this thing today. In Egypt, laborers and employees are gaining more and more political power, and I don't think that's anything to brag about because I tend to view things like democracy as not much more than a scramble for the gun. A friend of mine had a really great idea for a T-shirt showing people sort of climbing and stepping on one another as they all reach for this singular gun and just titling it democracy. The state is a criminal organization, so whoever controls it is
criminal.
Like criminal. Like, and not cool criminal like Tony Soprano cool. Okay, not like that, because Tony Soprano's the one exception to the criminal organization rule.
I thought he was kind of – he was the of all the mafia bosses, he's my least favorite of ever to hit the big screen. He was
– he's a family man, you know? I can dig that, you know? He's just like an everyday guy. Anyway, this can sound really attractive. You know, the workers, they're getting more say, finally, and – the trick of the state, and it's one of its self-perpetuating mechanisms. It's like a fail-safe, is to grant us a power. I think Rabble Rouser, A.K.A. Michael, has
dude anonymity
has often said that the biggest trick of the trade is to show us a bunch of reforms. and to subdue us into thinking that we have say over it. So while on the outside, on paper, it always looks great for the workers and for the laborers to be having more of a say. But when they're gaining more power, what it is it's a pyramid scheme where the very top 5% are the ones who are going to benefit from it most. So really, just change the vocabulary a little bit, make it a little more abstract, and you just have one group of people who are donning the robes of the tyrants. And it's not something to be joyful over because it's just more of the same. Really, we just need to bring the whole fucking thing down and work from the bottom up, and we'll be a lot better off in a lot of ways.
From the bottom up, that's a good pitch for the show there.
Thank you.
I like that. I like the premise that you stunk in there. It was nice.
That's the trick of propaganda.
Okay, we have some kind of sad news being reported from the front lines of resistance in Chiapas. Chiapas has been rife with resistance for, 15 years now. 16 years, there's been a strong resistance movement there that a lot of us know as the EZLN or the Zapatista movement. But there's also a bunch of mining companies. Chiapas isn't just a small little village. It's an entire state in Southern Mexico. For anybody who doesn't know geography that well, don't feel stupid because I once thought the Panama Canal went through Cuba. And my wife reminds me of that anytime that I make her feel stupid for something.
I used to think Jethro Tull.
In my face.
I used to think Jethro Tull was the guy. Turns out it's a group of people.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious. So I'm sorry for that. At least I'm fucking being honest about it. I could have hid
really,
that from you people.
I didn't know it was a group. I thought it was really a guy. I'm serious.
No, seriously, it's really a group.
That's
right?
A really stupid band name.
I know, it's a really stupid band name.
Like, Dave Matthews Band is called that because the dude's
name
is Dave Matthews. It just makes sense.
Exactly.
But Jethro Tull, like, why would you give your entire group the name of one man?
I know. It's a total dick move. I agree.
Fuck Jethro Tull.
With his flute.
This one time, if you can. Fuck Jethro Tull. Yeah. He what? What does just... But the Luddite is not a name of a person. That's the name of a group. But, like, you wouldn't confuse Luddite with being a dude you hang out with. Well, this dude at work, Luddite? Yeah. I mean, I guess you could now if you work with some anarchist primitivist, like, train hopper kids. Like, this dude's suitcase that I hang out with? What's up? You know. I don't know what you're saying to me anymore. But some serious news here. There's a lot of mining going on in southern Mexico, and there's a lot of corruption involved with this, but the people of Chiapas have come together and started an anti-mining organization, and one of their leaders, Mariano Abarca Roblero, he was shot and killed in front of his house and in front of his family on November 27th. Just weeks after being kidnapped by state authorities in a form of rendition, it was declared to be, by international law, illegal, and so they had to release him. And immediately after that, he was gunned down in front of his home by Blackfire employees. Blackfire is a similar thing to Blackwater or any other mercenary group that's for hire by corporations. Once again, proof, I think, that the economy needs to go and then the state will crumble. You're going to argue the other way. But you know, these fucking beasts will stop at nothing, but so will the resistance. And that's where we're coming to a head, is two groups that will stop at nothing and which one's going to win.
A friend of mine actually came back from Iraq 2 years ago, and while he was there, he was a Navy CB, and he actually, like, witnessed Blackwater troops, and they get a lot more, they're a lot more free with who they actually get to shoot, and, you know.
Sure, there's no accountability.
That kind of thing, and that's been going on through the news a lot, so, I mean, the military is just kind of like, hey, we're guards, while these guys are the actual hit squad that are actually doing what they think needs to be done, and, like, everybody, like, frowns on the military on the fact that, you know, hey, you're joining this. No, but there's actually people being hired to go out and kill by, you know.
Sure, either way, it's fucked. You know, putting on a uniform sucks, even if you're just frying, you know, potatoes for $6 an hour. Like, at any rate, you're putting on a uniform for somebody else. That's pretty shitty. But when your uniform is meant for you to kill innocent people, well, you're entering into a whole new realm of D-bagness.
Mike Cannon, who hosts an awesome show called This Week in Radical History, posted a video today on the Facebooks about some of the soldiers that are being trained in Afghanistan, like the Afghani people really like to smoke a lot of hashish. And it's fucking hilarious because these guys, I mean, these guys are, okay, just picture me joining the military. Okay, if you could have seen me vacantly looking at the milk carton with cords in it today, like this is fucking total devoid of intelligence, like staring at it, just seeing a sea of cords, not knowing what hooks into what. Imagine that in the milk. And so it's really funny because they're showing this video and these American soldiers are trying to talk to these guys and they're like, hey, what? And this is universal language, by the way. I don't know how many people here are full-time functioning stoners like me, but there's a certain universal language that we speak, which is standing far away and kind of going, what? So the guy's like, hey, come on now. Hey, you soldier, come on now. Come on over here. I see you. You know, he's being funny for the camera. What are you smoking? The guy's like, I'm a dude. He flicks this thing. Flick, right? They go, what'd you flick over there? I think I know what that was. And he goes over and he picks it up. That's the hashish. Is that the hashish? No, I didn't know. It's not a hashish. So then they're talking to this general guy, the general, who's like, I'm so uninterested in our Afghani army at this point. Like, these guys don't care. They're like kids. I don't even know. I mean, I just don't care anymore about my Afghan army. And these guys are like these kids, and they're totally not into it. And it was fucking hysterical. And we're spending a shitload of money to basically get a bunch of, like, 18 to 21-year-old stoners into outfits to fight. And shocking news, they don't want to because they're high.
They're hungry.
Yeah. They like can't remember how to, they don't remember how to put their helmets on right. This is so me, by the way. I totally relate to these guys. They don't know how to fix their fucking guns. Well, it's not they don't know how, they can't remember. It's fucking awesome. So the hashish warriors of Afghanistan kick ass.
Oh, sure. That's been one of the center points for a lot of the wars. I'd say all of the wars in the 20th century, at least, has been the movement of drugs, of drug culture.
Yeah,
and it was called the Golden Triangle in
1960, all over again.
It was called the Golden Triangle at that time. But, you know, we just see that moving. One of the biggest exports of the region that we're in more of right now is, of course, the poppy, which is, you know, heroin. And the Taliban has actually placed bans upon it in the past, but then realized how much it pisses off American lawmakers that they grow poppy to such degree. And so just to spite them growing it again and supporting it. And, of course, when the Taliban supports the growing of something, that means that they force people to grow it as a cash crop. So support equals force everywhere you go. It's pretty great. I like the way that works. But back to the article really quick. The murder of this anti-mining organizer, it's making some waves, not as much as it should, of course, when anybody gets murdered by the state, but it happens every day. I think that what my view of this is, it's a prime indicator, along with a lot of other cases that we're seeing, of exactly the threat that is posed by individuals and by small groups of people who really do give a shit. A lot of times, you know, when we're working out there together, we feel so fucking small and we feel so useless, like we're not making any changes. I would just say to look to the amount of surveillance that they've put into play, the amount of energy they've placed into silencing, and the amount of energy they've placed into propaganda to thwart any efforts that we've made. And that's just proof to me that when we're making them work that much harder to silence us, that we actually are, we're doing what needs to be done.
Absolutely. And, you know, we make fun of Alex Jones a lot on this show because it's easy and he's a dick. But his show is a great example of the lengths with which disinformation, active disinformation, will go. One of the claims that he made was that the anarchists at the G20 were just surrounded by cops. We're just staying, you know, protected by police. And it's an amazing thing because there's a lot of info wars. There's a lot of individuals who are really into that and really think it's really, really radical. And occasionally some tidbits of useful information will come out of it, but this is the lengths with which the system will go. They'll be saying, yeah, totally radical, you know what I mean? But it's a fucking politician saying, Dennis Kucinich is not radical. He's a vegan fucking weirdo. Yes. Not a radical.
His wife is smoking.
Way hot. H-A-W-T.
Wow. That's all I got.
Which is bizarre.
I don't have any intelligent commentary.
She's like 6'4", and he's like 5'1". That's fucking bizarre. That's like...
women are objects to ogle about. When they are politicians on television, yes. Because anybody that puts themselves on television for that reason is an object to ogle about because there's nothing real beyond that spectacle.
Okay.
Absolutely.
It's like...
If you have a TV, sure, I don't have one, but I've seen them, and they're interesting. And it doesn't, whether the, you know, you could jump on me for being not a feminist, which I don't think I am not a feminist because I enjoy sexuality. I think sexuality and sexism are two very different things. I am a healthy sexual beast. I may not look like it, but underneath this, I am a sexual animal.
Really, really
and
hairy.
To express my sexuality is not sexism. I'm not objectifying her when I say that she's fucking smoking. Now, when I say she's fucking stupid, because maybe she is, I don't know what my impression of her would be because I've never heard her say an intelligent thing in my life, I could assume that she's stupid. But that's making a comment upon her intelligent being. When I say that physically she is smoking, yeah, she's smoking. I'm attracted to that. Now, I'm also attracted to a lot of other things, but I don't feel I'm objectifying them because, number one, I don't have a point of profit to make from this. I'm not profiting in any way by saying that I'm sexually attracted to these beings. When I say that I'm sexually attracted to something, it's because it turns me on. I don't know why it turns me on. I may be a product of this culture. Let's take another opinion. John, are you there?
Yeah.
Yeah, John, we're talking about objectification. Everybody, this is John Zosen. Can you guys yell a little louder to make him feel bad for not coming today? Can you hear that, John?
Oh, I feel bad. I feel bad.
Yes, this is what democracy looks like.
Calling in from Hollow Earth here. I wish.
From Hollow
Earth. That's awesome. You are my... I have a man crush on you now, John Zerzan. You and that fucking beard. That beard.
Oh, I know. It's too much.
Don't objectify John Zerzan.
I'm sorry. I was objectifying John Zerzan just now, but he's got a great ass.
So, John, how was India?
What's that?
Hello? How was India? Can you hear? Are we coming through?
Oh, it's kind of broken up. Oh, I had a great time. It was really fabulous. It was, you know, we were there a year ago, but just got our toes in the water a little bit. But this time was really too much. In fact, actually, literally too much. There was in Nagpur, gave 3 talks in one day, and there was this press conference, and then I got sick. It was just too much for the old man to handle. But I bounced back, and it was really memorable. It was so great.
Awesome.
There's lots of interest in the, you know, the perspectives that are anti-industrial, anti-mass society, anti-civilization. People really wanted to talk about that.
What brought you to you were telling me this on the phone that there's not only a lot of interest but it's been something that's been there for some time and it was kind of witnessing a re-sparking of this fire. Can you talk to us a little bit about what the dynamics of that is, what that looks like?
One thing is, I mean, there's sources like Gandhi and Tagore who talked about simplicity and self-reliance and the village. You know, that's the whole. In a way, it's the relocalization, decentralization stuff that we're talking about now, you know, without any reference to India. But, you know, it's none of this stuff is new, and India is just as much a source of it as any other place, I'd say.
Sure, sure. I mean, it's fallen under a lot of the same economic structures that we see in every burgeoning first world nation joining the global economy. But I think that the destruction there has been afoot much longer than that because it's been a resource for other first world economies for so long.
Mm-hmm. And now, of course, it's being pushed into high gear like China, the huge industrialization push with of course, the massive pollution, the giant assault on indigenous people there. That's a key thing. You know, they're just trying to... crush the Adivasi, as they're called, or tribals, you know, these names, they refer to the surviving indigenous people, and there's a lot of them still there in India. So that's a big war that's going on. They're trying to mine these the homelands of these people that have been there forever, and it's really a stark battle that's going on.
Yeah, we saw some interesting things happen. I guess it's almost, maybe it was 2 years ago in Mumbai, which is a hotbed for the wealthy to come, and it's one of the largest districts of impoverished people. And I remember talking about this on the radio show when it first happened. There was some quote-unquote terrorist attacks at the Ambassador Hotel of Choice there, and immediately we got on in the a lot of the anarchist shows were talking about how this blame is going to fall on Pakistan, and it's going to create preemptive ideas to go into war in Pakistan, and a lot of people disagreed with that. People like Alex Jones, D-Bag, disagreed with those ideas, but then, boom, 2 years later, we see the grand firefighter and supreme opium dealer Obama joyously taking us into Pakistan to kill poor innocent brown people there with the assistance of a lot of the governmental services of India, and we're really using them as a port for that. So I'm really hoping that, you know, what you witnessed there was the burgeoning of a really powerful resistance movement, because God knows that this is not an American problem. This is a worldwide problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well put. We were there during the at the one-year anniversary, the November 26th thing that you referred to at the Taj and other parts of Mumbai. It was kind of interesting. They had this huge parade by the police in Mumbai, and about 100 people showed up. It was completely embarrassing that everybody just ignored it, like they didn't want to, probably for various reasons. They sure as hell didn't celebrate the cops there. We just drove right through it, like there wasn't any, you know, they had a lot of cops, but nobody bothered to show up for their parade.
That sounds kind of like the DNC. Last year, there was a lot of cops, but there was just a few of us there looking around like, what the fuck? There's like five dudes hanging out in the park eating food, not bombs, and there's 350 cops right here, and they're not eating food, not bombs. What are we going to do?
So, John, I'm going to ask you, it's been 10 years since Seattle, and just for kind of our listeners, for everybody here, can you talk a little bit about what do you think were some of the things that kind of put you as a kind of media spokesperson for what went down in Seattle 10 years ago? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, the media thing? Well, you know, I mean, a huge part of it, I think, is if they talk to somebody, they have to kind of create the importance of that person. Otherwise, people would say, well, why are you talking to that dude? Or, you know, so, you know, it's a self-creating thing in so many ways. But one of the things that I enjoyed the most, actually, I remember, I don't remember if it was Time or Newsweek, they had three people that they fished up as somehow, you know, all about Seattle. It was Kaczynski, me, and Noam Chomsky, and it drove Chomsky just nuts. He just couldn't believe it. You know, that was what I enjoyed the most, is it just got way up his ass that there he is with the Unabomber and me. You know, he just couldn't be. Yeah, couldn't have been more uncomfortable with that. I got a chuckle out of that.
It's all about the company that you keep, John. I mean, that's why we're so excited to have you on this show, as well as some of the past guests. What we're really doing is we're trying to compile all of the FBI's 10 most watched list in one space at one time. So.
I mean, do you know how much that gives us so much street cred?
Seriously, dude, it's awesome.
Yeah. Dude, man, Truzan, I don't even, man, Patrick Friedman.
So 10 years after, we've seen a dramatic shift in the way that street resistance looks in the U.S., and it's also had somewhat of an effect globally, but specifically I want to talk about the U.S. because that's where the fuck we live and that's who the fuck we are. We're here. What have you seen as... I've seen a shift, and I know you've seen this shift, and I know a lot of people here have seen away from Chomsky's kind of somewhat post-left ideas of syndicalism, which you know, I for one think that Chomsky is a wellspring of information. Now, I don't think that he's a source to go to for solutions or answers, but if you want information, he's an encyclopedia of information. But we've seen a shift away from that into what's, you know, all the names that are given to it: green anarchy, primitivism. What do you think? Do you think that Seattle played a part in waking the consciousness that has led to this shift, or do you think that this is just a natural evolution of any resistance?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it got a boost from Seattle. I think it really did. But then maybe it would have happened anyway. I mean, some people say, well, you don't have to have riots to push shit. If you've got good ideas, they're going to go forward. I don't know. I'm not sure how it works, but I think it did happen that way. I mean, you know, again, back to the media, and I'm well aware that some people, you know, various anarchists say, don't talk to media, that's all fucked up, you should never do that. But, you know, we did this 60 Minutes thing because I felt, I think those of us who did it or decided to do it felt like, well, this is where you call the shots. The media pretty much has to explain why certain people would do very militant stuff in the streets of Seattle. So, you know, we were calling that thing, and actually it was a decent job too. I mean, they did give us the space to kick out ideas. I mean, that was one little example of it, and you know, we couldn't complain about the you know, it was pretty straight up. It was okay. It was factual, so why not do it, is my opinion. You know, somebody's out there in Ohio or Alabama, they never heard about any of this stuff, and maybe it'll be a while before they do. Well, they might turn on the tube and catch something and then pursue that. Think, you know, break out of their isolation a little bit. That's the way I looked at it anyway.
Sure. Yeah, I think the media is a great source for breaking us out of isolation, but, you know, what I found is in my move from the Midwest to the West Coast recently is that there is this kind of this idea a lot of people on the West Coast feel that they are on the vanguard or the forefront of some resistance. I forget that West, who for generations have been resisting, and I think that a lot of that points to a lot of the mountaintop removal resistance and things like localized resistance that just don't get the headlines for good reason. It's a good reason that there's headlines all over Seattle when young kids are breaking things, because 5 years prior, Seattle was the hotbed of musicians and this I don't give a fuck lifestyle that grunge music really put out into the world. I remember when grunge came along and destroyed punk rock, because punk rock used to be about giving a shit. Grunge comes along and all of a sudden we live in this Nirvana-based world, which is such a funny name for a band that talks about not giving a shit about life, Nirvana. But, not that I don't like Nirvana, because I do. I think it's great music, but it really is music that doesn't give a shit about anything. But it happens in Seattle, the hotbed of that. All of a sudden, it's headlines. But we see a lot of this resistance all over the world, and the media doesn't pick up on it. You have talked a lot about Guy Debord and the Society of the Spectacle, which is really great stuff to read. Can you talk about how that's influenced a lot of the ways that your philosophy and the way that you speak now versus how it would be without the understanding of the spectacle?
Oh, well, the Situationists were a big influence on me. Yeah, for sure. Like in the 70s, when that really started to show up here as a resource, as something you could tune into, it was pretty slow. You know, it was already, 60s had been defeated. That movement had been defeated. So that was part of it, I think. Some of us got inspired by the Situationists, what happened in the French May, you know, back in 68, and learning about that and how things can just happen. And you know, I remember talking to somebody who was in Paris at the time, and he said, these kids got up there in front of these huge crowds and just made these amazing apocalyptic comments. And people just said, yeah, that's right, and took off, you know. And I remember, you know, these old commies who were just left in the dust, didn't have a clue, you know, didn't, these bureaucrats who were trying to control that movement. And, you know, it just seemed kind of magical. I mean, that's part of it. You know, so it was really, it caught the wind. It was, you know, they used to say, our ideas are in everybody's heads, you know, even though you don't read about it. And they were partly true. I mean, that was pretty much the case, I think, to some degree, although I wasn't in France, so I wouldn't know firsthand. But, yeah, that was a big thing. I mean, to me, Debord was... he was always too much of a Marxist, but I would say Raoul Vanegem tuned in a little more to the kind of utopian impulse, the anarchist impulse, where I was anyway, and that was more of a rush than Society of the Spectacle for me personally.
Okay, well, you know, I think the one thing that I want to talk about with you, which I think is interesting, is the divided communities of people on, you know, in the in the resistance and revolutionary thought, which I think that revolutions and resistance are two different things, and that needs to be distinguished of what the difference is between a resistance and a revolution. A revolution being where one group wants to overthrow power and exchange it for another form of power, and a resistance being a group that wants to resist all power that comes from the outside of their own autonomy, which are two very different things. You've talked a little bit about the Zapatistas and how that resistance has changed into revolutionary thought and what the dangers of that might be. And that leads into the talk about the divisive names and politics in which we work on this side of the table. Now, I can find you 300 million people who would advocate for civilization. I could find you maybe 50 people who vocally in the movement are publishing or speaking against it, the ones that are getting voice at least, which are usually white males, because those are the ones that usually get voice anywhere, voice that we're all going to hear, because, I mean, that's the voice that sells, apparently. I mean, you're talking to two white men who is having a conversation on the phone with another white man. But beyond those bullshit divisions, let's talk about the divisions of thought, the divisions of philosophy, Marxism, anarchism, and why we on the left continue to denounce our comrades based upon some language differences. Isn't there a greater resistance out there that we need to look past and be connected with one another? Or do you think that this self-critique, internal critique, is good for us, is good for building a cohesive movement?
Well, I think I tend to see it as the latter. I mean, I think we've always got to be critical. Once we start making the compromises and glossing over stuff, then we're kind of on the road to the people we oppose, it seems to me. And, you know, you brought up you're just bringing up this thing about how very few people find any value in the critique of civilization. There's tens of millions out there that don't. But, you know, hey, we haven't found out yet. When we haven't cracked into the discourse, the public discourse, who knows? Who can tell? And I have to point out, I mean, this is my read anyway, I point out that it's people like Chomsky who are preventing this in the first place. I mean, we can worry about the rest of it later, but, you know, he's completely wildly against any discussion of this. We've asked him for, you know, let's have a public, you know, airing of this stuff. We disagree, fine, but let's open up.
Didn't he refer to you as a genocidalist?
Oh, yeah, he's done that a lot, but he won't do it out front. See, one of the things that's happening with this, just to, you know, go on with this for a second, I think that more and more when, like, he's interviewed, people will, they might bring up, or they do bring up this thing, well, what about this primitivist stuff? What do you think about that? Is there something to that? And what I've heard is he has a stroke. I mean, he just gets livid. So he can talk all this shit and prevent certain amount of discussion, and I've been in various countries. I've heard from people. He's been there too, and he'll say stuff. And I'm aware of this stuff. He wouldn't say it publicly, but he's out there. He's a leftist who's trying to block this, like a lot of people on the left. We've got to break through that first. We haven't even won the battle completely in the anarchist milieu, and so yeah, it's one thing to say, well, let's have solidarity and let's not quibble and backbite. Well, shit, man, if people like that are working against us, I'm not going to give him a pass. You know, he's a fucker. He's not on my side. He wants the industrial life is what he loves, man. He wants more factories. He wants more of this shit. And you know, how does that make him a comrade of mine? You know, fuck that.
Tell us how you really feel, John. Let's get to the root of it.
I feel like you're holding back just a little bit.
That's the first year, right?
No, I love it. I love it. Yeah, you know.
But you know, I was reading Andrew Flood. I'm sure I know who he is. I was reading his critique of.
I know you know.
I was reading his critique of primitivism the other day, and I'm not a primitivist. Although a lot of the ideas, of course, resonate with me largely, especially a lot of anti-civilization stuff. But it got me to think. You know, his main criticism was the population question, and he had a few quotes from you in response to some of his critiques. And it got me to thinking about what I perceive as a potential dark side to primitivism as a social ethical framework when I got to thinking about the population problem. Because the first thing that occurred to me is, well, if you have somebody who's really, really hardcore, if you had the opportunity, if you had a poison that would remove 98% of the human population and leave you and your maybe you and your collective alive, and maybe a few other groups alive, but for the most part took everyone out, you know, would you do it? And that was a question that popped in my head. So I'll ask you, do you think that's a reasonable question to ask based on the criticisms, or do you think that's too much? I mean, how do you respond to the population question?
And John, before you get to that, I want to ask you, before you respond to that, if it's okay if others in the room come up and respond as well. I just kind of, we have a room full of people here that I know are passionate about ideas, and I'd like to open this discourse up a little bit.
Absolutely.
Are you okay with that, John?
Oh, yeah, that's
okay. So anybody, this mic is going to be open. Just don't interrupt any other speakers while they're speaking. And John, go ahead and take that question away, and then we'll pass it around if anybody else wants to address it.
I think that question's fine. I mean, no question should be off the table. But, you know, the people I'm working with and the people that I'm aware of or tight with, that would be a hideous response. That would be just so incredibly misanthropic. That's not where we're coming from whatsoever. And when you know, I've been in some of these giant cities like Sao Paulo, Istanbul, and you know, and just recently, last week, you know, Calcutta, Bombay. It seems to me that we are the ones who are concerned about those tens of millions of people who are going to get snuffed. They'll be dead in a few days if this thing crashes, or when this crashes, when it fails. And it's the people who don't want to talk about this stuff. It seems to me they're the irresponsible ones. If anybody's a genocidist, then it's the people that, you know, want to block the discussion. What the hell's going to happen to all these people? You know, how are we going to start moving away from this suicidal course? How are we going to reskill ourselves and reconnect with the earth and abandon the cities and all that stuff that I think is pretty necessary? It's time to talk about it. And it's not time to just rule that out. If we want to just go on pretending that this whole nightmarish course of industrialization and all the rest of it is just going to work out fine, well, that's the head in the sand attitude that the dominant society is all about. But that's not where we're talking at all.
Yeah, I got to say, what baffles me most is the lengths to which people will defend that which destroys them. Specifically, so when that question is brought into play, they want to point to people who have ideas. Now, we don't have weapons or implements to do this. We don't have the ability to end 98% of the population, but there are people who do have those abilities. They are the business owners, they are the bankers, they are the government, they are the financiers, and the militaries do have within their reach the ability to eliminate 98% of the planet's population. Yet we want to criticize those whose ideas state that we have drastically raped and destroyed this planet for our own perceived wealth. And when I say perceived wealth, I want to say that there is no wealth without a successful relationship with the land and with each other. There is no wealth. There is no wealth. It's all fake. It's all fucked, and it all doesn't really exist, and it's all going to kill you. But they will point to us as being genocidalists because I don't think that it's necessary to have CAT scan machines to look for diseases to be cured that were caused by the civilization that can cure them. It's like they offer us this bully momentum of, well, I'll protect you if you pay me. And that's exactly what modern medical science is doing by saying, I can cure your disease that I gave you. And
exactly.
When we look at civilization as the root of disease, then we can only, the only assumption that logically, compassionately, ethically we can come to is that civilization being the root of disease must go and cannot stick around to solve the problems it creates. You can't ask the rapist to lead rape counseling. It's just that simple. They have to leave the fucking room. So that's my input. Anybody else?
I totally agree with that.
Let's see. We'll have some fun questions, John. Let's talk about there's a lot of arguments going between primitivism and other forms of anarchist thought, specifically around the ideas of consumption and consumptive-based ideologies. Let's talk about the meat-eating and the non-meat-eating, the argument and the debate that is ripping at the hearts of every anarchist potluck. is this vegan? And the follow-up question, of course, is, do I give a shit? So let's talk about that. What have you seen? What are your thoughts on this, on the philosophy of consumption?
Well, I mean, I'm impressed with people who are vegan. I was in Brazil a couple years ago at this thing, hundreds of young anarchists there, and it seemed like every one of them was vegan. And I got some shit for not being vegan, I'll tell you. But they were great. They were on fire. And I think one of the things that I have a little problem with is that I think they have sometimes a pretty ahistorical look at things. I mean, you know, we existed for a couple of million years not as vegan. And I think the vegan thing is a great critique, you know, of the whole industrial thing. Industrial food production and industrial domestication and everything else, but people were eating meat way before that, and so are we going to condemn, you know, Homo erectus and, you know, people that really had it pretty well worked out for so damn long before civilization came along? I mean, I think I can't quite see that, but, you know, they're living it better than I am. I mean, they're walking the walk better than I am, so I'm not going to – I mean, I respect that. And that opens up a whole interesting discussion, and I think it's cool. I mean, I've got straight-edge friends, and, you know, I think about my own bad habits of alcohol and everything else, and I think, shit, I'm glad somebody's strong that way, you know. I need that stuff, and I'd like to improve, but I doubt if I'll get that far as they are.
So you do think it's a progression, a natural progression of will to have this lifestyle, or do you think? Well, okay, let me Carl with a K has some stuff. Carl with a K.
Well, actually, first I wanted to Mr. Zerzan was speaking about how we had been consuming animals for thousands of years before industrialization, and I did actually recognize that. On the one hand, it is a really important tool to critique our current capital industrialization, and it's a very important movement in order to react to that as far as people being vegan and how much of an impact or a lack of contribution to those industries such a diet has. But, for example, things such as dairy, et cetera, have only ever been consumed by you know, our own species within our own species and only during infancy, especially in the natural course of human beings.
Again, I will retort by saying that if human beings are the only animals to drink another animal's milk, it may be because we are the only animals that make cookies. That's a joke, Jesus. You guys are the most unsympathetic audience. Zerzan, the people that you bring out are the coldest
hearted.
I could see why Chomsky would call you a genocidalist if you could see the looks on the faces. These people want to tear me a fucking part right now.
They got like, really serious when we mentioned this
shit. Like, you know, I could joke about cops, I could joke, but I'd make a joke about cookies and all of a sudden I'm a dick. Like, I need to fucking go. This is ridiculous.
But
go ahead and address
it. Yes. John, I wanted to ask you a question. I read, I've got one of your articles printed up from your website, johnzerzan.net, and I was reading one of your articles yesterday, No Way Out, and I wanted to ask you about one of your lines in it. I'll just read it out loud for the audience. Symbols have largely crowded out everything real and direct, both in the daily round of interpersonal interactions and in the accelerating extinction of nature. I agree with you to the point that, you know, I mean, I've heard contemporary Christian rock, and it is poisonous. It is poisonous.
No. He doesn't just hear it. I get phone calls from this motherfucker.
I'll call
three
him.
Times a week, like, dude, I'm watching this YouTube video right now.
Dude
you guys, I'm the Facebook you with it.
Just go to YouTube and look up Jesus Is My Friend and watch a ska video from the 80s. Jesus is my friend. No. I have a friend in Jesus. No. When I hide, he reaches down inside me. Anyway. So I can see what you're saying in terms of art and music being things that can separate us from reality, because that's what Christianity does. on the other hand, though, I think art and music are really amazing and are a part of what makes us human as an animal. So, I mean, how broadly do you apply your critique of your symbolic culture, so to speak?
Well, I've just thrown some stuff out. It's speculation. Maybe it could have been written in a better way to make it sound less dogmatic or something. But it's speculation. I mean, who knows? maybe we'll find out down the road if we get a chance to move towards some kind of disalienated life. But I just have noticed the correspondence. I mean, I think that's what it basically is to me. Like what Marshall Solon said about work, the more symbolic culture there is, the more work there is. And that's true. I mean, he didn't even say why. I don't know why, but there it is. And you can look at the early emergence of, you know, of art, of cave art and the rest of this stuff in the Upper Paleolithic, and then notice that it's also the emergence of estrangement and the beginnings of hierarchy and stuff. So is that just a pure coincidence?
In other words, I think there's something missing there, John, though, in your critique of that, is that, and you do critique this as well, and I think if you tied the two together, you might have a cohesive thought, and you wouldn't just have to say, oh, I was just talking some shit. you could actually tie it together, that it comes from division of labor, which comes from, as you say, division of self, and we could talk about the Christianity aspect and all religious aspects of that stemming from a division of self and God creating the first hierarchy. Once God was removed, because we read a lot about, and we're going to talk about the noble savage theory later, but we read a lot about primitive cultures having a relationship with God, a relationship with animals, but they also had art and they also had music. In fact, the music a lot of times was, in shamanistic cultures, a way to connect with God and connect with the planet. So music was always there, but the division of labor has brought about specialization, which creates a hierarchy of levels of, well, your song is better than that song, so your song is going to sell more, and I'm going to package it, as opposed to everybody being able to be a musician. But I do despise when I hear everybody's a poet, because I've been to open mic nights.
Everybody's not a poet.
Everybody's not a poet. Like,
that is a lie.
It's a damn lie. But no, I mean, what do you think about that, though? Tying those things in, division of labor being related to symbolic culture and the bastardization of it.
Well, that thing about everybody's a poet, I mean, we could say that maybe most everyone had the capacities on a spiritual level, if you want to call it that, that shamans began to monopolize. And that's a specialization, possibly the first specialization. And so,
Do you think shamans monopolize?
Cool, but, you know, that it's, why does that get kind of, in a way, swallowed up by one person, one expert in the field? That's what you see all over the place. Maybe there, when you've got a more equal access and a more equal practice, then you don't need the specialists. And that's, you can, it doesn't, it's easy to see how that progresses. Marx, that's what Marx's original thing was all about. You know, he not only dropped the subject, but he even reversed himself. Well, this division of labor isn't so bad, you know, because we got to have machines and mediation and reification, well, it kind of comes with the territory. That was a complete reversal from the early, some of the early stuff where Marx was thinking about, what is this all about? What is technology? What is the means of production? What does it do to people? Well, he dropped that. I mean, that's a interesting case study in itself, I think. But that's the whole thing. How much alienation is okay? I mean, if you can see the roots of it, well, then how much do you have to get rid of, or are you just going to keep, imagine you can keep it at bay. To me, it's not, it doesn't stay there. It's like cancer. You either deal with it or you don't. You can't just say, well, a little bit of it is okay. Well, a little bit of it will just keep growing and bite you in the ass in a big way, right? So, you know, that's not the way to look at it, in my opinion.
Well, you do understand, though, and I've heard you address this before, so I'm not just saying you understand because I'm assuming it. You do understand that that's where the link between a lot of the language of fascism comes into a lot of the ideas of a very passionate culture, whatever it may be, but it's specifically anti-civ culture because it's, of course, the quickest thing that somebody who is defending civilization will use is they'll resort to ideas like to say that you're a fascist or to say that your ideas are fascistic because there is no other option. They don't understand, I guess, that there is no other option, like that the ending of civilization does not come with reformation. It doesn't come with, well, some of it can stay and some of it can go. But how do you address when you're targeted as that, when you're targeted as being somehow fascistic or somehow genocidal because your language is without compromise?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not speaking for other people. And again, we'll find out. I mean, that's the way it strikes me now, but I mean, maybe it doesn't work that way. I mean, you know, and this fascist thing drives me crazy. I was in Germany, and, you know, that's exactly true. And, you know, it's really amazing. It's why the political culture there is so toxic. If you bring up even the anything to do with health, anything to do with the ecology of the environment, you're a Nazi. You sound like a Nazi. I mean, it's really unbelievable. That's a good way to keep everything so fucked up and backward. If you know anything about German radical politics, it's really a mess. I mean, it's got some of the weirdest things you can imagine. And there's no the primitivists there that have started shit up. They have gotten hounded and harassed and just, like, you know, put out of existence. That's really a bad news thing. If you can get away with smearing people with that shit, you know, and all I could say was, you know, I'm not from here. If I was part of this whole history and everything, I'd see it differently. But I'm an anarchist, dude. Don't run that shit on me. You know, don't talk about Nazi or stuff. That's just stupid. So, you know, I really, it's just so frustrating. I don't even know how to deal with that.
Yeah, no, it's a ridiculous of a coward and somebody who obviously doesn't have a concept of how to intelligently deal with things, but it's one that exists, so that's why
we're
talking about
it. Well, yeah, and it also exists even closer to home. Postmodernism says that, it seems to me, you know, because they're always insisting there was always alienation, there always will be alienation. In other words, they're sealing the doors. You can't get out of this. It's a very fascist position, in my opinion. It really is. I mean, because then, you know, anything, if you are talking about anything else, then you are somehow in favor of some closed system and some absolutes. You believe in strange things like presence and wholeness and lack of mediation. That's just ridiculous. I mean, maybe it sounds very crazy to say it, but I think there's a real link, because they're the ones much more effectively than fascism. I mean, that's, you know, how many decades ago was that? But this is operative right now, and it works to close off things insofar as it's still around. It really does that in a very sophisticated way. You know, we could talk about that for a long time, because it's one of my, you know, pet hates, you know, because that's more to the point. That's the culture in so many ways, and you can see how it operates.
Well, I guess one of the things that I want to talk about, stemming from these ideas of division and separation and absolutes, and this is something that's been burning in the community, every community I've talked to, when it comes to anti-civilization or primitivist ideas, is this feud between you and Jensen. I know that you have the courage and the will to get up and talk about it openly, about what it is. Can you give us an idea of what the fuck is going on? Because, I mean, I know this is that you guys have a personal relationship, but to us, to a lot of us, it's just kind of like, you know, dude, I love you both,
okay.
And I really don't, you know, like, a lot of us are just like, I really don't fucking care that you guys are pissed at each other.
I know. Because
we love you both. But give it to us. Tell us. Break it. Don't pull any punches.
It's very, very unfortunate. And, I'd rather that this wasn't happening, but here's the background for that. Green Anarchy magazine, a year and a half ago, published a signed review of Derek wrote this anti-zoo book, very good book, and the review was quite positive, except it raised a question at the end. It was an open question, as I remember the review, which nobody even noticed at the time. It said, well, does everything go? Is everything cool, you know, in terms of resistance? And anyway, Derek picked up the phone. He said, we're done. We're finished. We're no longer friends. GA, I never want to hear from you again. And just went totally off. And so I said, Derek, what are you talking about? These are just, it says in two or three places in the zine, these are just the opinions of people. And it wasn't even a very negative review. Nobody saw it that way, and he just flamed out, just completely flipped out. And I couldn't get him to say, come on, man, we're friends. What are you talking about? I mean, you know, I mean, so you hate the review? That's okay. I mean, we all get a lot of shit. I mean, big deal. Anyway, it's just kind of gotten worse and worse. And finally, well, a year later, when he starts making, you know, being all palsy with all these progressives and liberals, I just thought, are you just sliding off into, you know, collaborating with them and supporting them? That's not good. And at the same token, here's another bigger example, is what's happening with the EZLN. And I am no expert on that, okay? I do not have any definitive thing, but I will raise a question when I see the subcommandante making all these leftist comments. You know, he said, well, I'm an urban leftist intellectual, but I'm here to learn from the indigenous, and they have so much. Well, after a while, after that gets established, now that's taken a big turn, it seems to me. Maybe I'm wrong here, but, you know, if you follow that at all, from the public stuff that's in English, you can see that there's a big leftist thing, and he was denying it for the longest time, but maybe now they got their hooks in, and, gee, what happened to the indigenous thing, you know? Anyway, that's a question. I feel it's good to raise a question, and I feel it's good to raise a question with Derek Jensen, because nobody is off limits, and certainly I'm not off limits. That's healthy. It's not healthy to be doing a lot of bickering personal shit. That's nowhere. But these are important questions. These are, you know, if you're linking up with the left and, you know, raising money for these progressive outfits, whatever happened to anti-civilization, man? You tell me. But now,
and I also want to say, in response to that, John, that and it's just like, when I heard about the story, you know, I was just hearing about who you guys were. When I heard about the story, it actually, I think it's a good lesson for anyone to learn. Whenever we read philosophers or activists or whatever who we find really compelling and we get really, really into, it's also really important to understand that and remind ourselves that these cats are not messiahs. These are human beings. They fart. Sometimes they stink, you know, like they might have really bad breath. They're often really pompous and really into themselves. They have lots of problems.
He just called you pompous, John. Are you going to take that?
Or they are like super stoned hippies who call into radio shows. They could be anything at all.
Sure.
But I think this is just a really good example of these guys are humans and they fight. And that's okay. That's good because there's this gamut of becoming like a cartoon character philosopher where they're kind of just ethereal beings. And no, they're just dudes, and they're sensitive, and sometimes they're big fat babies, and it's kind of funny, and we should just take it all in stride, I think.
Okay, yeah, man. You know, some of it gets stupid. I mean, we're stupid. I mean, nobody's all possible.
Yeah, no, I think it's good. It's just unfortunate when there's so few outlets that we can turn to now. I mean, Democracy Now! has for a long time been this mediocre voice of reform in a lot of ways. You know, of course, NPR we've never been able to stomach listening to. And it's just unfortunate when that we do find some voices that we resonate with, they have to fucking hate each other. But
you know,
I guess it's cool.
One thing in my defense, maybe, I think I could be wrong here, but I think every time I've mentioned Derek Jensen, I have boosted his books. Just like any time I've mentioned Kaczynski, I say that, in my opinion, industrial society and its future is just priceless. It's so important. I try to always say that about Derek's books, even if we're having some disputes and even if I disagree with stuff. I really think everything I've ever read by him is really first rate. So I try to throw that in as well.
Yeah, you do, and that's one thing that before I contacted you, when I heard you doing that, I gained this high level of respect, and I was like, I talked to Seth, and I was like, you know, I really do want to contact him because I really feel a kinship with this. Like, I think it's important to note while we have our differences, like, of course, I mean, a lot of Jensen's works are some of the most important works that we're seeing coming out today, and it's well written, and I mean, despite whether or not you guys may get along right now or both of you throwing a fit, both of your voices are so fucking important, and I don't want to hear either one of them try to silence the other, and I understand there's been some of that. I don't want to focus on it on our show anymore because there's a lot much more cool shit we can talk about with you.
Okay.
So are you content with that bit of that conversation?
Oh, sure.
You mean you don't want to air publicly any more of your grievances? Are you sure?
Oh, well, I got some dirt, man. Don't
Jesus Christ, John, I'm telling you, these fucking people are dead.
We have an audience of dead people.
John, say something funny.
Tell us a joke.
I'm going to see if it's just that I'm funny.
Say something funny.
Say something funny, John. Do it.
Oh, no. Now I'm choking up.
Do it.
Oh, wow.
Do it. Say the funny thing.
the funny thing. Well,
Three, two, one, go.
I should have jotted a joke down. Derek's much better at that than me. And that's what that's why his books are so good. I mean, they're accessible, they're personal. I'm just now trying to be a little more personal in the way I write, and he's got it all over me in that sense because he's got really good ideas, but he doesn't forget that he's an individual and he brings in his own life history. And I think that's terrific. You know, that's great. That's you know that's and it's also why he sells way more books than I do. I think
his books are at the library.
Yeah, so are John's. He's got one copy of each of his books in the library here.
I'm on account.
And I can't get any of them. They're always checked out.
Oh.
Always. But I can print off your articles. It was funny. I was talking to John the other day, and I was like, we had talked about how we both woke up at like 3 in the morning and couldn't get back to sleep. And I was like, yeah, and I even tried reading some of the articles I printed out written by you, and that didn't even work.
Wow.
God, they're really not laughing, John.
Care. They hate us. They hate us. They're looking, judging.
So, John, we've got Seth Martin here today. You remember Seth?
Oh, a voice of sanity at last.
I'm going to bring Seth on to play a song, and then I have another special guest who's on another line that has a quick report. We want to have him on just for a few minutes, but we'd really like it if you can stay on. Can you stay on right now?
Oh, sure. Yeah, great. Yeah, great.
Okay, awesome. Well, everybody, John's there so far. Can we give him a hand for calling in tonight?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, see, that's going to make you feel bad for not coming up because they all had hugs for you.
I know, man. I'm
sorry. Each one of them got a hug. That's all right. We're going to see you on the 27th, though, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll stick around on the line, and right now we got Seth Martin's going to play some music for us, and then we're going to come back with a special cannon fodder report, something we've been missing here on Burn for quite a while, and maybe we'll hear about why that is.
Good. Okay.
Howdy, John.
Hey, Beth.
Wow.
Here's
when I was going to say. What's that?
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing well. Here's one called Goodbye, Goodbye.
Oh, choice.
Feel free to sing along if you want. You're in the open mic crowd.
Tonight I heard the wailing sounds of a million wires underground. Save us. Don't give a damn, he still sings, nobody's listening, or cares what they're missing, goodbye, 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 out with the old bodies for the new race. Make haste to find a new place for the waste. These faces and their living tombs have rooms with views. Rooms with views. Who'll buy? Who'll buy? Who'll buy? A book, a second opinion, blurs letters mistook. I'd one time for treason, and the owl on a perch, bone piles beneath him, moon aids the search. Hungry for something alive, alive, alive. Promised kingdom, blood and tears and sweat reply from mouths drowned out by televisions and funeral. I turn toward the sky, funeral. I turn toward the sky. Alive. Well, the music man finishes playing his tunes and smokes his last cigar in a hostel room, screaming out a song about all things connected. Oh, the ego has fallen, and we're all infected.
You anarchists don't have to join me, of course, but it makes me feel better if you do. You know, don't fall out on me right now.
Goodbye. There you go. Goodbye. Million wires underground, save us.
Thanks, y'all.
All right, Seth Martin, everybody. Seth is an old friend. He was a friend that burned before burn was burn. Just an idea. John, are you there?
Hello. I don't know if John's there still. We're going to bring on one of our oldest lovers and a close friend of mine who I miss dearly.
Love him.
As soon as I can get my computer to actually work.
Is that you, John? Do we still have you?
Something is going on right now with my computer, so we may not be broadcasting right now. It's acting a little silly. Yeah, it's kind of stuck right now. It muted me for some reason. I don't know what's going on. It's muting both of us right now, so I apologize to all my listeners. Carl with a K, where are you when we need you? Carl, can you throw up in the chat room there that the computer is just frozen for a second? It'll be up in just a moment. The show is not over. And
this is what a poor radio show looks like. We're all about examples and showing you how it works. You can start your own media.
And congratulations, you're all at the only anarchist event in history to not ask for donations.
Woo! So, because we know you don't have any money.
Not this week, but in 2 weeks we will be asking for your money. Are you guys having a good time out there tonight? Thank you all so much for coming out. I know it sounds like I'm mocking you a lot and making fun of you, but I really love the fact that I don't know any of you and you all take time out of your day to come out here for this. I really hope that you'll tell your friends. We are a new format for Portland, and I am new to Portland, so it would be nice to start seeing a real community get built out of ideas of discussion and discourse. I just found one of the biggest problems that I found in my time is that any community I've been a part of has always fallen victim to only really coming together in times of crisis. meaning that we're really good at when we really need each other's help, but we're not really good at being there when we don't really need us to be around. And I think it would be really fucking nice to have us come together. I don't know what's going on with my computer here. It's really pissing me off. This thing is all frozen up. I don't know. But yeah, it would be really nice to start seeing each other on a more regular basis, and that's going to lead us into a lot of what we're going to talk about. They can hear me? The show can hear me. Okay, well, John, can you hear us? Are you there? I don't know if John can hear us or not. I really don't know what's going on here. But okay, so you can hear me in the chat room. I think that one of the biggest problems that we see has come about thanks to the surveillance state is this need, and there is a need for security culture, but I think that we've brought that too far. I think that we've brought security culture to a point of elitism where we're so scared to talk to one another about daily things that it's separated us as a community. And that's when I feel that surveillance culture really wins, when we start to police ourselves in a way that we separate ourselves from one another. Even if we disagree, I mean, G20 and I disagree on nearly goddamn everything. And we're still, like, really close friends. We're best friends.
I have a man crush. By the way, no, in case any of you don't know what a man crush is, I'm happy to explain it. A man crush is where, you know, okay, like, all right, so I really like Brad Pitt and George Clooney. Let me explain. It all started with Ocean's, the trilogy. And I just imagine, like, that George Clooney wears cologne really well, and that, like, Brad Pitt...
Nobody wears cologne really well.
And that, like, Brad Pitt kind of stinks. And I have this, like, fantasy where we're, like, playing football, you know, we're playing catch, and like, you know, I drop the ball and Brad Pitt puts me in a noogie and tousles my hair. Anyway, so a man crush is where I'm not wired that way, but if I was, I would. You know what I'm saying? So that's a man crush. Meaning that I don't want to have sex with Rabble Rouser, but
he would.
I would, you know what I mean?
In a pinch.
If it was really cold.
I am wired any which way that I want to use them. You know, so I don't really care.
I'm just saying.
My co-host smokes a lot of pot.
A lot.
And he smokes resin. This is affecting...
Resin. Smoking resin is like going to the bottle return. You know what I mean? It's just like...
This is pissing me off so bad. This isn't
like
working. I really want to get these callers in. I really want to have John on the show more, which he's still on the line. Thank you, John, for sticking around. I hope you can hear this. But... something is fucking up here on my computer. So, what do y'all want to talk about? Well, do you guys find a more irony here that the technology fucks up when we start talking anti-civ?
I'm just saying.
And it pisses us off.
Weird.
You know, we get on this bet, we're like, fuck civilization, fuck technology, and then it starts shitting on us, and we're like, God damn it, why can't you just work? People are machines,
that's nice.
Too, I think is what you mean to say.
Ooh. See how
the place just kind of emptied out. Like, there's only a few of us left. Can we start making fun of those that left now?
Yeah.
Does anybody know any of those people that left? You guys got some juice on them, some good gossip?
They were scared of our ideas.
Anybody got anything to say?
Maybe it was the FBI and they're like, oh, these guys
suck. These guys are no threat. Cops. Cops. The cops have left. Yay.
Okay, so, yeah, this sucks.
They can still hear us.
I don't know. They can still hear us, I guess, so we can continue doing the show. Some of the things that I wanted to talk about, and as soon as our callers can be heard again, as soon as this computer stops fucking up on us, we'll have their input, if you have input on this too. Some of the security culture things were something that's really been pressing. And a lot of the stuff that John and I have talked about in the couple conversations that we've had on the phone have been a really interesting movement that we've seen grow, that we've talked about on the show a lot, is this movement of Christian anarchist primitivism. And I think there's some people here that can explain to us. Seth, can you join us back up here again? Seth is the de facto representative of Christian anarchist primitivism at this moment, because he's one of the only Christian anarcho-primitivists that I talk to on a daily basis. But something that we find that I find to be interesting is the community aspect of Christianity is really strong. It always has been. The church has always been a place that has really come together in a community and built strong ties for many aspects of their life, not just for their beliefs, but in their daily discourse. And with the anarchist community, there's been times when it's like that. There used to be a time when you could go to any city in this country and in a few other countries and immediately recognize your family without ever having talked to them. And now there's a lot, I see it a lot in Portland, being new here, I see these divisions within the anarchist community of people that don't want to talk to each other, that don't like each other, that despise each other, or people that don't know that each other exists. And I blame security culture for this. I blame this idea that anything that you do and say is getting jotted down into a notebook and to be used against you. And it may very well be so. Somebody may be writing it down, but really, honestly, are we going to let that take away our lives? And I think that what the Christian anarchist community offers is they offer an openness that we don't see in other communities. And I think if we could sense that, can you talk a little bit about what you feel when you, I've been to a few of the conferences with you and a few without you, and being a non-Christian, I've always been welcomed into these conferences by most of the people.
That's good to hear. Yeah. Well, I haven't openly identified as Christian anarchist for much more than about a year, but that's kind of a full journey for me, and for me it gets back to the idea of radical being roots and getting to the root of your what makes sense to you. So I don't have the way I understand Christian or anarchist, I don't have an agenda to make you either. So it's more an understanding of what the roots mean to me, and there's a radical community in that personified by Christ, but also personified in the community, which actually started out as an upstart spiritually motivated political community that was resisting Rome and all that Rome represented. And ironically, like a lot of anarchist communities now that are actually like Anarchist TM or Anarchist Incorporated, the very name which symbolizes a radical group has become a new institution in itself. So the Christian anarchist community are people who have consciously grown up or taken on that kind of background as Christian, but they understand it fundamentally for life from a bottom up, the mustard seed idea. That's a community, and it has God in everyone, God in us, and we understand that through our own context. We're not Buddhist or Taoist, and we have no problem with people who are or whatever. We just are talking about our own roots, and that's part of a...
Well, we is a royal term, and I think it's that's a dangerous...
Let me speak again. Yeah,
that's a dangerous
I never say that
line
usually.
To tread, but what I found to be interesting is one of my understandings that I came to respect a lot of the Christian ethos. I mean, obviously, the teachings of Christ are pretty fucking phenomenal. For anybody who's not a Christian and hasn't read the teachings of Christ, you should. It's pretty phenomenal teachings, despite what the church might tell you.
Well, the church exists because they're phenomenal. Anytime you have truly radical teaching, I think, in my experience, as I understand it, when a truly radical revolutionary thought comes along, you will always have it endorsed and reinterpreted by the institution. Because it represents a threat
Absolutely.
To that institution, so that's why you accommodate and you take it in.
So the church exists to co-opt and calm.
Because Christianity is revolutionary and the church is fundamentally against that. So
sure.
That's what the church is.
So basically what you're saying is the colonial religion, which Christianity has become, was already colonized. So it's a colonized
yes.
institution as well.
Yes, which is the way that I understand my own faith as... being my faith and my own tradition is one of being colonized and then trying to go beyond that and use the very same roots to react against the colonizer.
I was born and raised a Jehovah's Witness, and I am also a baptized Episcopal. And lately I've been having this kind of love affair with atheism. Not all the way, though. I can't quite make the leap, personally. I know, I kind of want to. There's a little bit of me that kind of wants to. And then what do? I say the fucking Lord's Prayer before I go to sleep. What kind of theological hypocrisy is that? Mine knows no bounds. I'm very open about that. And so, Seth, you're not, A, making anything any easier for me, so I guess thank you. And I do find it really compelling what you say, though, about the idea of radical ideas getting appropriated by the institution, because the Jesus movement was a first century Mediterranean Jewish movement. It was grounded in Judaism. One of my favorite things to say is that the original followers of Jesus were not Christians, and that usually gets a pretty awesome reaction. And by the way, do this. This
Neither
is
was
fun.
Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, do this. This is fun. The next time you end up in a conversation with a really strong fundamentalist evangelical Christian, do this. This is fun. My friend and I did this to this kid. My friend is Greek Orthodox, and we had a lot of fun. So we sat down with this kid, and I have a point to all this, by the way. So we sat down with this kid, and I said, okay, is God a man? And he said, well, that's how he chose to reveal himself to us in the person of Jesus, so yes. And I said, okay, now, does he have a penis? And he looked down, right, and my friend, the Greek Orthodox, is laughing because the idea of God with a cock is hilarious. And the kid, he's looking down, and he can't answer me, and I say, okay, well, while you think about that, let me just ask you this. If God has a penis, is it eternal? Because if it is, I have so many questions, you know? Like the idea of a
cock. No, it's not. It's not. We all know that Jesus was God and he was hung like this.
Hey-o! I just want to say, the idea of a cock that permeates all matter is fucking amazing. And then I have all these questions like, does he have saggy balls? Are they cinched? You know, is he circumcised? I'm just saying. Jewish guy, just saying. So the point is this.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is, I mean, we, in our circles, we joke around about this same stuff because it is so entrenched to think, and you can realize that even when you don't believe that God is some gray-haired man up in the sky, the language has been fortified so long in that way that, and it's not just Christian language, Christians speak, but our own English language is so fortified to enforce all these ideas of male associated with power, and that's part of where all this comes from. You know, Christianity as an institution is associated with the power structure, so of course God's going to be a powerful male, even though the very scriptures that it translates from are rife with not only contradiction and paradox, but they're rife with Christ using female imagery. Mm-hmm. They're rife with mystical imagery. They're rife with God as an animal symbolically. They're rife. But the main point is God is that which can't be named. You know, and I think Zerzan probably has a lot more than I can say about where this plays into language in general.
John, are you with us?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Nice. Yeah.
And I want to say, John, you're with us, and also we've got Cannon online who's with us, and we have, it looks like, Brother Cadell, the hillbilly anarchist, calling in from the Fightin' Cock Flyer Network, which is a radical news source in Kansas.
Wow.
Is online as well. All three of your lines are open.
Well, we were open.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, I'd love to hear that.
That's some privilege.
There you go. You're right. What is I guess it's the old adage from my own tradition is, what are the fruits? What's coming out of it, basically? And that's.
And by the way, my whole point that I had in telling my God's penis story, Seth kind of summed it all up way better than I could have. So that's what I meant. Everything he said was what I meant by how big is God's cock. So.
I feel that the problems that exist with God as an anarchist. My initial problem with the God idea, the God concept, is when God becomes this removed idea. When we remove God and create a hierarchy between God and myself, of course, as an anarchist, I'm not just against governments. I don't give a shit about governments. I'm against unnecessary authority and hierarchy, domination and control.
Absolutely.
Things that I feel we should all be opposed to.
Amen.
So, as the Christian says, amen. And I feel that once we've made that separation, that God is something that is dominant over us or controls us, that's what allows us to control other human beings, because we're being controlled by something. I, however, don't feel that relationship with God. I do feel that there is something that I can, for lack of a better term, call God, that is this driving force of love, deep-rooted love, that drives us together. And that when we come together, we create these beautiful things, and there's a feeling there. And I don't care that if I'm losing anarcho points in saying this, but I feel that calling it God, that's okay. I don't really give a shit what your view of God is, because I'm not going to allow your views distort my relationships. And I think that we allow people to do that a lot.
various aspects.
Hi, Ben, fellas.
Kansas here, Radio Free Kansas. Various aspects of liberation theology would definitely agree with you, Brother Franklin. And there's certainly other aspects. However, I wanted to pose a question to your panel there. How do you interpret the majority of interpretations of Christianity today, the majority interpretation of Christianity today in the United States strictly, is the weaponized gospel of Jesus Christ, the homoerotic figure of a Jesus with a sword in his hand waging war across the world in order to wipe out the infidels on the other side, those who are not believers in Christianity. You see that in the Air Force. Most notably, Max Blumenthal in his book Republican Gomorrah writes about that. Out here in Kansas, while I would have more than welcome a Christian anarchist perspective based on liberation theology, I find mainly the dominant aspect, especially among youth, has been to buy into this weaponized gospel of Jesus Christ, which is...
Well, they actually, in Kansas, they actually killed a friend of yours who was in church. Based on their interpretations of this God complex, Dr. George Tiller, who you knew and you worked with and you were close to and friends with, was killed at church while his wife was singing in the choir by a man who was claiming to do God's will. We think that the arguments between you and Derek are deep. Just think if you guys were pulling guns on each other. These Christian fanatics are fucking insane.
Yeah.
Well, my priest used to say, when I used to go to church, she used to say that coming to the confession office, I'm going to fuck you, is what my priest used to say to me. I was like, what?
We're not making light of that situation.
No, we're not making light of priests fucking people. Anyways, God damn it, now I forgot what I was going to fucking say. Oh, yeah, she used to say that if Jesus ever walked into a church, they'd kill him, or they wouldn't notice him because they'd be too busy practicing Christianity. Which I think is kind of a profound statement of how far removed. I got my degree in religious studies and philosophy, and I find it interesting that there's such a strong endeavor to this is a first century Mediterranean Jewish movement. You know, this isn't an American thing, and it's the method by which it's been appropriated has been appropriated by civilization and by all the symptoms of civilization. The state and big business, they all use these images and the vocabulary to bring us in. But it's like anything else that's appropriated by violent organizations. It's twisted and it's skewed and it's distorted. And it's put out there by the talking heads so that a massive amount of people, will say things like, God, Christians suck. And it's true, a lot of Christians do suck. I mean, that's true. A lot of religionists really suck. A lot of them are really amazing people, though. I mean, Seth is up here playing beautiful music. He's a man of faith. And, I mean, that's a pretty amazing thing. So I think we need to take it with a certain grain of salt. The amount, I mean, there's 3 billion professed Christians on the planet. That's a lot of people. And in no way, shape, or form can any of us in this room make a general statement about that.
That's a highly flawed number, personally. But
I
think it's a number that quite benefits the power structure, which for this global capitalist thing. I think that's an inflated number that makes them look good. Notice that there's 6 billion people on the planet, and they're claiming that 3 billion of them believe in the same God that they do.
Well,
that's beneficial to somebody.
My words were that there were several billion who claim Christianity as their religion. Now, there's a huge number of people who go to church every Sunday and don't believe a fucking thing that they hear. There's a sizable number of people who actually claim to be atheists who still go to church. So I'm not implying uniformity of belief.
Well, I think John or Cannon or Cadell, did you have something else you want to say on this? Because if not, I'd like to get to cannon fodder if we could.
Okay.
I just want to back up one thing that was said, that the thing about community and that we don't have very much of it, quite frankly, in the anarchist milieu. And, you know, when I was in Memphis in August, I just felt like there's something that nobody can miss here. It's really good and it's really healthy and it's very palpable. And I was intrigued right away by that. You know, that's what we got to have. We talk about community. Well, where's the community? Something's going on here that just seems very authentic, and I want to be open to it. So that's that's kind of my bottom line on that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that one of the most beautiful things about the Christian anarchist community is their openness, their welcome arms, and their openness for those who don't agree. Of course, it's not across the board, but most of the people that I've dealt with in that community, in fact, a lot of them that are in that community say that they don't adhere to Christian ideas, but they are driven by the story of Christ to become better people for themselves and for their families. I think that's great. And their community aspect is really, really solid. They know each other. They love each other. They support and respect each other. Now, the problem is, of course, do they love and support and respect others outside of their community? And does our community love, support, and respect them? I'd like to see that start to happen. I'd like to see there be a combinations of the communities, because I really don't give a shit what God you pray to at the end of the day. If you're fighting cops on the line with me, then you're my fucking comrade. As soon as you become one of those cops, you're my fucking enemy. And I don't care if you call yourself an anarchist like Brandon Darby does. He called himself an anarchist, and he was a fucking cop. That's the enemy. But Christian anarchists, Buddhist anarchists, Sufi anarchists, Baha'i anarchists who are willing to be on the line with me or get my back and are not cops, don't act like cops, I call them my lovers, and I'm connected with them. I don't give a fuck what you call yourself.
I know you're running out of time, but I'd like to, and I'll leave you with this, Kansas perspective. I think it's more akin to understanding also how Christians treat those who have left their group. Particularly, I'm reading this certain passage in Max Blumenthal's Republican Gomorrah, dealing largely with Christianity and the state power, where the young man who was demonized by his church, the New Life in Colorado Springs, Ted Haggard's church, destructing with Ted Haggard becoming we all know about what happened to Ted Haggard. The young man was demonized by the church, and he went back with a gun and slaughtered four people because of years and years and years of mistreatment by his parents and his church. And Ted Haggard found himself back into the church 3 weeks after he repented from being diseased with homosexuality, and the young man could not find his way back in, and in frustration slaughtered and committed mass murder in Colorado Springs after that. I think there's a difference between liberation theology and how we engage in the puritanical part of spurning and shunning those who are different than us, whether they believe in Christianity or whether they are from us, from our families and stuff. That's how that's done. And I think two quick DVDs, Collapse with Michael Rupert coming out soon, Collapse DVD, and Constantine's Sword, which deals quickly with this kind of militarized gospel of Jesus. And thank you. I got in late, and I'm sorry, but I enjoy your show. And congratulations on pulling off your technical thing. And hello, Burn. Hello, you people out there on the West Coast. Good night.
That's our comrade in Kansas. All right, we got our comrade a little further east. Well, Cannon, are you here?
Yeah, well, on
can
now.
We real quick? Well, we obviously have an audience member. I was going to see if you.
Yeah, go ahead. Hold on 1 second, Cannon.
Okay.
We just have an audience member come up to the mic. We'll let him say what he wants to say.
Isn't that on the switch?
Hello?
Okay.
I was just all this talk about community and stuff like that, like how to. I think it's all about how to enact change, and I think that's the most important aspect of any discussion or anything that we partake in, and I think the world works on a microcosm, macrocosm way, where the things that we see, like control that's being caused on one level, it can be seen on a smaller level in different ways. And I think Shakespeare said that the whole world is a stage. And
we are but the players.
And we are but the players. And I think that from the position of us humans working in the world. There was an ancient art that was part of the stage that hasn't really been talked about much recently. But there's an ancient art that I want to bring up into the minds again. It questions, like, what if the world is a stage and we're about the players, then it questions why the people on the stage are on the stage. So so I wanted to do this last week too, because I won't explain it, but it's just kind of like asking the question. It's working on a microcosm level of, like, this stage here that we're working on. Like, if we can enact change here, then we can enact change out there. So if the whole world is a stage, why are you on the stage? And here's that ancient art.
So that guy threw a sandwich at us and ran outside, and Michael chased him. Thanks for tuning in to the show. Anarchy in the UK. Freedom.
Okay, so I just had a sandwich thrown at me by a nonviolent pacifist who fucking ran for his life.
I now smell like hummus and onion.
Yeah, so I don't know if he understands this, but I've never once claimed to be nonviolent. So I'll see him in the future. I'm more pissed that he wasted the last half of my dinner for the day by throwing that sandwich at me, because that was my dinner. But I'm going to fuck him up. So. That's not simple. He comes here a lot. I hope Mighty Waters respects that, that he's going to get fucked up. Fuck me. Did he throw a sandwich at your face?
Dude, I stink like onions and hummus now.
If he stuck around to talk about it, that would be different. But he fucking threw the sandwich and ran like it's some fucking hilarious joke. That's fucking disrespectful.
And my wife is, like, not going to touch me when I get home. I stink like fucking onions.
And my fucking computer is covered in chicken.
Sandwich now. And things, and, I mean, he mumbled something.
Why fuck me? Well, this is the relationship quandary we're talking about here. Somebody does something abusive. Somebody does something. This is on topic. Somebody does something abusive to somebody else, and the person who was the victim of the abuse is then chastised for fighting back. Microcosm, macrocosm, there it is. There it is. So we got Cannon on the line. Cannon, tell us what's going on.
I don't know if I can stop laughing, my friend. I'm so sorry. That's really pathetic. It really, really is. I mean, he's kind of cool about the whole Wicca way about, you know, as above, so too below, which I dig a lot more than Christianity doctrine, but boy. Dude, that was just crazy. And the microphones are going all over the place, and it sounded like you were being raided or something, you know? I was like, holy
God. Oh, my God.
I didn't know if the feds had just busted in and tried to shut down your show or what the dealio was, so.
I don't fucking know. I don't know. I guess it takes a lot of will for somebody to stick around for 2 hours just to throw a sandwich at somebody. Like, you've been waiting 2 hours to throw that sandwich at me. Like, at least you stuck around to the end of the show.
That's dedicated.
John, are you still on the line, too?
Yeah.
Are you sure you still want to come up on the 20th?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, you got such a wild-ass show. Now I'm afraid to come there.
You'll have the band.
No, I'll be seeing you.
Well, okay, so the show is going to be on. John, I want to say thank you for joining us tonight. Before we're not going to close out right away.
Okay,
but,
thank
everybody,
you. Sorry, I couldn't be there.
John Thurston.
Thanks so much, John, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Just stay on the line if you want. We're going to be on for a few more minutes. We can keep broadcasting.
Okay.
So, Cannon, what's going on in your part of the world? You done laughing yet, brother?
Yeah, I sure am. Have you cleared all the sandwiches from Easy Reach? That's my question. But
yeah, I've got chicken salad in my keyboard of the computer that I just got. Like, just was gifted to me by a friend, and now it's fucked with chicken salad. But apparently I'm the ass.
I hear you, man. We had to replace all our computers, too, after the raid. So, do you want me, just really quickly, just bring up everybody up to speed. I was one of the two protesters at the G20 in Pittsburgh that got raided.
Hold on, Cannon. Can you say it again? We can barely hear you. Cannon's telling us who he is and what's going on with that. Cannon, for everybody who doesn't know, Cannon was one of the two protesters arrested for twittering at the G20. He's been called a Twitterist at this point. And he's facing federal prosecution for some things related to this. Correct, Cannon?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, right now all the charges in Pittsburgh have been dropped, but there's still some kind of a grand jury looking into something relating to the Federal Rioting Act, which we don't know if it really does or doesn't, since both the Pittsburgh affidavit and the affidavit for the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force raid on our house is still sealed. And so, you know, they could be lying totally about, you know, their provocation for raiding our house for 16 hours and killing our pets. But, you know, we don't really know. So we're kind of in this Twilight Zone area waiting for the man to bust down our door again at 6 a.m. in the morning and wondering what's going to happen next. So... there's a lot of legal, you know, minutiae going on that, you know, we just don't have time for to really talk about on the show today. But interesting stuff, and I think it's an interesting, you know, thing that's happening in our authoritarian, you know, Gestapo-like tactics our Obama administration is choosing to use. But, you know, what can you do? You just got to keep on plugging on, you know, keep on going on as much as you can and try to stay safe as possible. And a little frustrating that, you know, I feel I have to, you know, kind of keep myself in check sometimes now because of the man is obviously interested in it. And it's also frustrating that I can't do This Week in Radical History, which I've been doing for, you know.
Yeah, it's frustrating to a lot of us that you can't do This Week in Radical History. It's one of the greatest programs that I've ever heard coming out of the anarchist community. It's a fucking solid program, and I miss it.
Yeah,
and I miss that I can't. I think the deepest effect of this is that being one of your close friends, I can't be in constant contact with you anymore. And, you know, I think that this is one thing that we need to talk about in this community is when the FBI does get involved, it disrupts communities at its core level.
Oh, and that's the intention, too. You know, that's their intention, too. And, you know, you've got to – you have to stay safe at the same time, especially when you know, you're already facing, you know, a couple of 5Gs and bills already for various stuff. So, you know, you got to kind of make those decisions and kind of fight the fights that you can fight at any given time. But, you know, none of us are not anarchists anymore. We've always been open about our politics, and we're going to continue to be so. And when they bring back my, you know, flag, my anarchist flag my mom made for me, I'm going to probably hang it on back up where it was hanging, you know, right above our door. And,
nice.
You know, the big old fuck you, you know, and that's,
whoa.
And, you know, and, but at the same time, you know, you gotta try to be safe and, you know, try to make sure all your P's and Q's, you know, your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed with everything in life now. And so, you know, there's real ramifications for government oppression. It's not surprising. A little surprising the Obama administration's, you know, bringing up a law that was, you know, created in 1968 to try to persecute us with. But, you know, not uncommon, not anything different.
You're
than
not
the
too
law
surprised.
Right. In Iran or any other place.
Right. Well, I know that a lot of us owe you a deep debt of gratitude for really saving the lives and the safekeeping of a lot of people in Pittsburgh. I don't know if it helps or hurts for me to say that, but it really did. The work that was done, that was nonviolent work, that was done, that was legal work even, it was legal nonviolent work that got you busted, was some of the most important work that was happening outside of the context of being on the streets, because it really helped keep a lot of people safe.
Yeah, and the good thing about it, the one good thing about it is it can't be stopped. I mean, they led us to do after the raid, it continued, and it's going to continue, and it just can't be stopped. It's too decentralized. It's too easy for other people to do. I mean, there's 20 other feats out there, too, that they alleged that we were doing. So, you know, they just can't shut it down, and, you know, supposed free speech in this country will continue, and, you know, they're just not going to be able to do anything about it. So if they choose to keep on, you know, persecuting us, that's fine. You know, we'll have to take it as we go, and there's not much we can do anyway. So, and I'm great, and I'm really grateful for places like this, and you know, the Kansas City. Cadell does such a great job with his show, and all the great media and support I've gotten from people. And just want to give a quick plug if anybody's interested in following this case. We got an awesome blog, thefriendsoftortuga.wordpress.com, and Tortuga's Spanish for turtle, so it's friendsoftortuga.wordpress.com, and they can kind of follow if they're interested in the minutia and the fundraising and all that kind of stuff that's happening.
Awesome. Well, yeah, we'll be sure to let everybody know too about Friends of Tortuga, and they can read up about that. Cannon, I'm going to have to let you go. I'm covered in chicken salad. And
we want to really thank all of our awesome guests, John Zerk.
Yeah, everybody,
and
please
Cannon.
Put your hands together, whoever's left here. And I want to thank the people that came out to support us. Thank Alley Cat, Carl with a K,
and the Golden Rock.
For really coming together to help us get this thing going. John, are you there?
Yeah.
John, did you have a good time tonight?
Oh, I sure did.
Excellent. Well, we'd love to see you again. Love to see you, actually, and love to hear from you again soon. So
great.
Please keep us
in a couple
radar.
Weeks, no sandwich whiz will probably be thrown at you.
Yeah. yeah. But this time, to try not to offend, we'll try to get the Bionic Baking Brigade to make a vegan pie to throw at you. That way we don't offend the sensibilities of Carl with a K.
Thanks so much, everyone, for tuning in. Have a great week. Next week, we're back with the writer of Our Enemies in Blue.
John, do you want to say goodbye to everybody?
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Yeah, next week we got Christian Williams.
Of Our Enemy in Blue. And then at the end of the month, we're going to have a bunch of amazing local music for everybody, along with our Ralph Robinson and G20 Sided Eyes. Beautiful, beautiful voices and senses of humor. We want to give thanks to our collective, New and Virgin, Bottom Up Radical Network, for all their hard work. God bless you guys, if there is a God. But we've debated that tonight. Thank you so much. Have a great week and a great night. Live in freedom.
All right. Hey, Cannon, we miss you. We love you, brother. And everybody, John, thanks so much for joining us. And everybody, take a punch, give a hug, and always stand up. And watch out for flying chicken salad sandwiches. Apparently, that's the upright way to make change in the world, is to fuck it up for people who are really trying to do something cool in the community. So way to go on that one. I'll see you next week, and I'm going to bring a fucking shield and a fucking handful of eggs, and I'll be waiting. All right. Love you all. Bye.